Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Welcome to Come to the Brink. I'm Zoe Flowers, and this is a space for those of us navigating profound life changes like loss, trauma, caregiving, and transformation. It's about what happens when everything you thought was solid crumbles beneath you and you're forced to rebuild. If you've ever felt like you're standing on the brink, this is the space for you. Welcome. Welcome to Come to the Brink. I'm Zoe Flowers, and this is a space for those of us navigating profound life changes like loss, trauma, caregiving, and transformation. It's about what happens when everything you thought was solid crumbles beneath you and you're forced to rebuild. If you've ever felt like you're standing on the brink, this is the space for you. Welcome. Welcome to Come to the Brink. I'm Zoe Flowers, and this is a space for those of us navigating profound life changes like loss, trauma, caregiving, and transformation. It's about what happens when everything you thought was solid crumbles beneath you and you're forced to rebuild. If you've ever felt like you're standing on the brink, this is the space for you. Welcome. Renewing the created fire. So now let us imagine that we have everything all together. We're clear about our intentions. We are not drowning in escapist fantasy. We are integrated and our creative life flourishes. We need one more attribute. We need to know what to do, not if, but when we lose focus. That is, when we wear down for a turn. What? After all this work, we might lose our focus? Yes, it will only be lost temporarily, but it is in the natural order. Here is a fine tale about it that in our family is called the three gold hairs. There is a saying in our family that story has wings. Via transocean migrations by my Magyar foster family, a number of the stories I carry flew over the Carpathian Mountains with them. When they fled their villages during the wars. There they lodged for a time in the Urals, thence sailing over an ocean to North America. The little ragged band and their stories, shaped by their experiences, then traveled overland down through the Great Forest to the Great Lakes Basin. The little core of the three gold hairs was given to me by my Tante Kata, a gifted healer and powerful prayer maker who grew up in Eastern Europe. And I have amplified that kernel here. In my research, I've spotted quite different Teutonic and Celtic stories that revolve around the leitmotif of golden hair. The leitmotif or kernel of a story represents an archetypal juncture in the psyche. That is the nature of archetypes. They deposit some nuance of themselves at the point of contact with psyche. As symbolic representations, they sometimes leave behind an evidence. Wending their way into the life stories, dreams, and ideas of every mortal. Dwelling who knows where, the archetypes constitute, one might say, a set of psyche instructions that traverse time and space and enwisen each new generation. The theme of this story is how one regains focus once one has lost it. Focus is composed of sensing, hearing, and following the directions of the soul voice. Many women are quite good at focusing, but when they lose touch with it, they become scattered like a feather. A feather bed bursts all over the countryside. It is important to have a container for all that we sense and hear from the wild nature. For some women, it is their journals, where they keep track of every feather that flies by. For others, it is the creative art. They dance it, paint it, and make it into a script. Remember Baba Yaga? She has a big pot. She moves through the sky in a cauldron that is actually a pestle and mortar. In other words, she has a container in which to put things. She has a way of thinking, a way of moving from one place to another that is contained. Yes, containment is the solution to the problem of all loss of energy. That and one more thing, let us see. So as always, we open by reading Women Who Run With the Wolves by Clarissa Pinkola Estes. And as usual, it's a perfect introduction to our conversation. So welcome, welcome back to Come to the Brink with Zoe Flowers. I am Zoe Flowers. And on today's show, we're diving deep into the realities of caregiving and the complex grief that comes from losing loved ones in more ways than one. My guest today is a dynamic and compassionate Sherry Pullum, an award-winning storyteller, artist, producer, and wellness coach who courageously uses her art and advocacy to foster healing, self-awareness, and resilience. Sherry knows intimately the profound challenges of caring for an ailing parent. Her beloved mother experienced a debilitating stroke. Her father passed when she was young and when her mother was young and her father as well. And simultaneously navigating the painful breakdown of a nearly 30-year marriage. Sherry and I have also written together and traveled around the country together, so we know each other very, very well. So this is going to be a great conversation. So Sherry, welcome to the brink. You made it to the brink.
Oh my God, I'm so, wow, victory. I made it to the brink. First of all, Zoe, let me just say thank you. I just want to start in gratitude and thank you for the work that you're doing, because this is so important. It really is. So thank you for the healing work that we've done together for many, many years. And now you're expanding that to this journey of healing through grief and loss and everything in between. So I just want to say I'm so proud of you, my sister. Thank my soul sister. Yeah, I was not going to, you know, I'm a fan of yours too, so.
Thank you. So let's just like start at the beginning for folks that don't know you. What were your early years like and what shaped you as a little Sherry?
Well, I will say that as a little Sherry, I was always creative, always talkative, for sure. Always knew I was born an actor, but like many of us, I had this terrible fear of rejection. And I certainly, little Sherry was definitely a people pleaser. And sometimes big Sherry gets that way too. But I know, you know, I'm self-aware enough now to know that does not serve me. But I also had, you know, a happy childhood. But it was also filled with trauma too, right? I grew up in an alcoholic household. And, you know, that was something that was be quiet, kept secret, all of that. But I think through my art, and I share that because I think when I really was able to own fully my art, I think that's when I really started to get to know myself better, to be more vulnerable and allow people to see that side of myself. So I would definitely say that that young little Sherry is still inside of me in so many ways. And she still has some healing work that I'm doing with my little Sherry. I call her Sherry Baby. My grandmother used to always call me Sherry. So I call my little Sherry, Sherry Baby.
And were you creative, like in plays and writing and dancing? Like what was your creative outlet like then?
So I also love to dance. So I think it was one of my natural gifts was to dance. And I danced for a bit. And then my mom and dad really couldn't afford dance lessons, formal dance lessons. So, you know, we're from Connecticut. So Artist Collective was just this wonderful place to go when we could finally get back into dance. So I was a little bit older by then and, you know, dance all the way really kind of through college. I also have always been a writer. So writing, poetry, I think even when I was younger, journaling, even though we didn't call it journaling, but writing, I certainly wrote even letters, and some of them were sent to people. Some of them weren't, creating stories. I love to read. I love to be in the mirror pretending I was acting on a show. Doing commercial work.
Yeah.
No, to answer your question, I wasn't in any plays, but I knew I was an actor, you know, on the inside. But I was, again, I think it's just that fear of rejection. I was really afraid for people to, I guess, not like me or not accept me at that time, but always creative. And the other thing is I used to draw.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know whether I still can. I've shared some of my drawings with you before. But
Yeah.
You can still draw.
I probably can if I really let that come through again. I guess they say sometimes if you don't use it, right? I think I just need to practice and use the muscle again.
Yeah.
So I feel like my creativity and my art, like I always felt as a child even that my art was going to be something, or my creativity would be something that I would use as part of my purpose, as part of what I do.
Do you feel like, so for me, also growing up in a home where there was alcoholism and lots of volatility and things like that, movies definitely was my escape, escaping into
movies,
the dream of Hollywood. You know, I can look back now as an adult and say that was escape. It was an escape. Do you feel like writing and things like that, do you feel like it was an escape for you, or do you just feel like it was something that you loved?
I think probably it was a little bit of both,
really.
I think part of it could have been an escape. I love to watch television. Sometimes, you know, we'd had family nights, so a lot of times we'd watch with our family, but then let's face it, you know, the TV didn't stay, you know, we didn't have the content we have.
No, absolutely not.
Okay. So I think the other thing is I also loved creating community, you know, being with friends. I loved being outside. I was a Fisher girl, really. I really loved being, my dad loved to fish and so did I. So that was another outlet, I think. I mean, I wouldn't do it now, but I would be up at 4 o'clock in the morning, 4:30 in the morning, digging night crawlers.
Oh, wow.
No, I mean, I was serious. Yeah.
Wow.
And my dad loved the outdoors. He was a farmer.
Yeah.
So he loved to fish. So when we were younger, because my mother worked at night, my dad was really the one taking care of us. So sometimes that could turn into a slippery slope.
Boom.
You know what I mean? Especially with somebody is an alcoholic. So I think for my mom, even too, I think there's a lot of normalizing, a lot of denial, a lot of secrecy. And then I think as a child, you know, you're just trying to figure it out and you're trying to figure out where do you fit in.
Yeah.
And I think some of that for me anyway, I felt like my role was to be the fixer.
Yeah, for sure.
To make sure, you know, and especially with my dad, to try to, you know, and the other thing of just trying to be perfect, right?
So
this is my son walking by, to try to fix a problem that you think maybe you are part of the problem.
Yeah.
Especially when someone kind of tells you you are.
I was going to say, where do you think the fear of rejection came from, and how
and why? I was just about to say, why do you think that you would think that you were the problem?
Yeah, I think because, you know, when people are not well, and obviously, you know, alcoholism is a disease. And if people are not emotionally well, physically well, mentally well, you know, they're angry and hurt people hurt. And whether it's intentional or unintentional, you know, it's like, I wouldn't do this if it weren't for you. If you could keep the house clean, if you would do this, if you would do that. So we definitely grew up in a, like, the Better Homes and Garden, you know, cleaning. I was the type, like, dusting every drop off the chandelier crystals, you know. So I'm sure that's probably where that type A personality for me, that perfectionism, that drive to be perfect, I think probably that's the underlying part of that.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I think it's so interesting, too. I was listening to your guest, LJ. LJ. Thank you, LJ. And one of the things she talked about was her grandmother and her grandmother saying, you're such a good listener with me. And it struck me. And I thought of my dad and me sitting with him, and he'd say, you know, you're the only one who understands me. And so I think when you think that you can make a difference in someone's life and that you could almost be the, I didn't have words for it then, but you could almost be the therapist. You could almost be kind of the healer for someone that you had deep empathy for. Even though he made me very angry, you know, as I got older, you know, we definitely sort of had our arguments, and because we were also a lot alike too. But it's such a mixed bag of emotion, because he was, yeah, because he was also a sweet soul with a huge, huge challenge.
Yeah. And I think folks drink something, you know, we hydrate over here.
Oh, listen, let me get my little water. I'm a hydrant right now too.
You know, that generation, they just didn't have the tools, right? Because on the one hand, it's like, oh, great. Like, daddy or mommy says I'm the only one that understands that. And on the other hand, like, that is a huge burden to put on a child, like on a young person. No matter what the age, you're still like the child. And I was still the child. And so many times being put in like these adult situations at very young ages, they just didn't understand like how damaging that could be.
No, they didn't understand, especially emotionally,
yeah,
how damaging it can be. I think my mom, as she went through her journey, and I'm sure we'll talk about that, as she went through her own mental health issues and her own struggles, she really did turn her scars into stars, and she really started to understand like, wow, I was really trusting someone still. And I knew, we talked about this a little offline, right? How did I know something is wrong here, but I'm still trusting this person to take care of the kids when I probably know that wasn't the best thing. You know what I mean? In the moment. Or him driving, you know, I can think of times where, you know, we were on the road and people stopped us and they look, hey man, you got kids in the back and all of it, you know? So, and we talked about it. My mom and I had a wonderful relationship, thank goodness. And we were able to really work through and talk about and unpack a lot of that.
Yeah.
So I'm grateful for that, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also think that's like so generational. Like, I remember being crouched in the back seat after coming home from a party, then like, you know, throwing who knows how many back. And I would just be laying down in the back seat, like, very young.
And you didn't have to have a seatbelt on either.
God, no. And of course, the windows were rolled up and they were smoking too. Like, it's just,
Yeah. No, my parents weren't smokers, so I didn't have that. Yeah, they weren't smokers. Yeah. And my mother was, she was not a drinker at all.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, she wasn't a drinker at all. But, you know, so I guess as you asked, that little Sherry, you know, she was a dreamer and still is. I think just took on a lot of responsibility.
Yeah.
That really wasn't hers to own.
A lot of emotional, spiritual responsibilities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. For sure.
And then when you were in your 20s, your dad passed. And do you feel like that was like your first real bout with grief? Like, what's your relationship to like the first time you really felt grief?
That would be when my dad passed.
Yeah. Yeah.
That, because though my dad, he was, you know, complicated. For sure. Yeah. I mean, people are complicated.
Yes.
Absolutely. Human beings. We're all I'm complicated. We're all
absolutely
complicated.
We're all complex. Yeah.
We're all complex.
Yeah.
So, you know, he was like larger than life to me, right? When we were kids too, because he was also with little kids. He was so much fun, you know, taught us to play checkers. Again, we fished all the time and played horsey, and he could outrun us backwards with us running forward. So we spent a lot of time together, right?
Yeah.
And I spent a lot of time with my mom too. I mean, she would come fishing with us, but she'd be in her little lawn chair reading her newspaper.
Okay.
Fighting the shame.
Okay.
Right. So my dad for me was really larger than life. And you know, you just think you're so, I wrote a poem actually called Daddy's Little Girl. You know, you're so strong, you're so fast, you're the best dad in the world, swinging from your muscles, soaring through the air, no cares, no worries, my spirit truly free. You singing in the kitchen, making piping hot biscuits, pork smothered gravy, and grits. The scent still lingers.
Yeah.
I remember. I'll always be your little girl. Now, girl, I did not think I was going to be reciting that.
And I love it. It's beautiful.
It just came out a piece of it, but that. So when he transitioned, first of all, I didn't think he would. I didn't, because he had been on the brink before. He had, you know, he had faced death many times. Even before he got married, he had this major surgery. His intestines were now on the other side of, on the opposite side of the human body, what our body is. And it was like one of the first surgeries they did in the United States on him. And this was before he was married. And I think that's when my mom knew, like, oh, I really do love him, because everyone thought he was going to die. His mother and father came, and he was very intuitive as well. And he said, you know, send my mom in. And no one had told him she was there, but he knew it. So he was on the brink many times. And that was before I was born. So I just heard of that story. But after that, you know, and also he was, what do you call somebody who's accident prone?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So if it wasn't falling off a ladder, bleach falling in his eyes.
Oh, God.
You know, doing things. He also was really great with his hands. So sawing and almost sawing the thumb off. I mean, just off. Oh, my God. Well, and then not to mention the fact, right? Yeah. Now you're also a drinker. You're also an alcoholic. So, you know, you're behind a wheel. Yeah. He finally lost his license, but, you know, so he flipped cars over. I mean, so there was just so much.
Wow.
Right.
Yeah.
So he just seemed invincible. And yet he was also really in good shape.
Okay.
So when my father, we found out that he had cancer, and we didn't even know, but we started to see he looked really ill. He looked sick.
Okay.
It's not until I went back and saw pictures of him later on. You know how sometimes when you're present and you're with it and in it,
for sure,
you see it, but then you, when you look at the picture, and I look at the pictures now, I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, really, really, he had aged probably, you know, 20 years.
Yeah.
He was so much thinner. We just didn't, you know, we didn't realize at that time, but I'd say how strong he was because he rode his bike.
Wow.
Like, you know, to the store and back a mile away. I mean, up hills.
Wow.
That's how, and even with him being an alcoholic, he basically had esophageal cancer.
Okay.
So he basically burned his throat out from drinking.
Okay.
And, but his liver was in good shape, his kidneys, I mean, all of it. It was, other than that, you know, he was a really healthy person. So I share that long, I know it's kind of long-winded answering that question, but I guess just exploring the depths of grief at that time for me, that was really, for me, kind of just really being a cross between denial. And then I ran away from it, you know, and my mother kind of immediately felt the grief. He was diagnosed in July. He was gone by November. And the cancer did not kill him. It was really, he died of a staph infection.
Right.
And he said, I will make it through the surgery just fine, but I will not live much longer after that. And he did not.
And how long, when did he say that? Like when he was in the hospital?
He did. He was on his way pretty much to surgery. And it's interesting too, because I remember when my dad repainted our family house.
Yeah.
And he said to my mom, this is the last time I'm going to paint it. Let your next husband do it. And because he was also such someone who had also a great sense of humor. You know, you just think it's kidding.
You don't take that seriously.
No, no, no. But he was very intuitive. He definitely had so much. Maybe that's where I get that from as well.
Yeah.
So much foresight.
Yeah.
So much rich vision. So I think for me, that was really the first time, and I would say for my mom too, that was the first time she experienced grief of that magnitude. Her mom and dad, like she said, I mean, her mom and dad were still living. She was spoiled. My father spoiled her also in many ways, even though it was difficult. I mean, she definitely went through some challenging times.
But they were young too, right? Like she was quite young when
she was young. Yeah, she was. I mean, he died. She was maybe 50. I think she might have been 52. That's young to lose your husband, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean.
Yeah. Wow.
I just think for all of us. So then when you look at that, how do you support one another when you're all, you know, as a family unit, when you're all grieving in your own way and you're all experiencing grief in this magnitude at the same time? So the way I was handling it was kind of, once he did die, once he did transition, I really was running away and I threw myself into work. Well, you still know that about me, Zoe. You had to bring me through from a couple of moments. Work. And needing to process and feel. So where my mother knew emotionally was going through that grieving process pretty much immediately when she found out he had cancer. But again, at first I started in denial. And my sister and I, I'll never forget, we went to the hospital and they said, you know, this is the last moment. Get to the hospital quickly. He's not going to make it.
From a staph infection.
Yeah, from a staph infection. And so we went to the hospital, and I think that was, I still can remember my sister and I walking in
holding hands. You know how the doors open so slowly? You know, you press the button to the ICU. She was on one side of him, and he couldn't talk because he was intubated. He was on one side. I was on the other. His hands were up like this. And we just both begged him not to leave this planet. And of course, whatever, you know, my April was, I'm so sorry for any grief. And I'm like, I'm sorry too. And, you know, we just poured our hearts out, and he couldn't talk. But I know if he could talk, he was probably say, can you put my arms down? We were holding one hand. I mean, and I was like, Dad, I'm not married. You have to live to see your grandkids. I don't love my children yet. And then April, who had children, three beautiful girls. And she's like, and you've got to live to see them grow up. So it was all of that. So then we realized the very next day, thank goodness he was still alive. And we went back and we apologized. And we told him, it's okay. It's okay for you to let go whenever you're ready. And what I will say that brings me comfort, and I hope anyone listening to this, maybe it'll bring them comfort too, is I really do believe that souls, when they're here, they know.
Yeah.
So when they said my dad was going to not make it, he lived. In fact, he lived for probably another week or two, because my brother was going to come and visit, and it was near Thanksgiving. And we said, Dad, Michael's coming to visit. You know, stay, you know, all of that. So I'll never forget this either. So when we were in the hospital, they said, oh, looks like your dad's going to make it. We're going to make plans now to take that tube out of his throat. It's like I said, it was intubated. And they said, we're going to make plans to give him a treat.
Okay.
Now, my dad, he said he would never want to live like that. And I can just remember him looking around the room. He had like hazel green eyes, and they were so clear. And literally, he looked like 20 years was like off of his life. He looked so young and peaceful. And he just looked at each of us. And for the first time, we didn't go to the hospital the next day early. We actually decided to not go so early in the morning and go a little bit later. And he died. He transitioned then. But when I look back, I know he was looking at us and making peace, and he was saying goodbye. We didn't know it at the time, but I am grateful that he had that opportunity, and he knew. So when the doctor said he's going to not live, he lived.
Yeah.
And he said, he's going to make it. Let's make plans. He said, I don't want to live like that. And who transitioned on.
Yeah. Yeah. They know. They know for sure.
They know. Girl, that's why I had to bring my little Kleenex. You see?
Bring your Kleenex.
Yes.
Bring your Kleenex to the Come to the Brink podcast.
Come to the Brink.
Meaning.
Yeah.
So you said you threw yourself into work. What did that look like? And how soon?
Oh, immediately. I mean, I don't think I ever saw, you know what I mean? The more projects I could do, the more things I could do, the more, you know, work I could do. The play that I started working on was Why Not Me?
Yeah.
This one woman show that I not put up on its feet or produced, but you and I remember we did a writer's workshop together. And I sort of got the piece in at least a little bit better shape. But I know one thing that my mom was on board with that piece, and it centered around my dad
and really alcoholism and family and what that really looks like in a family to have addiction in your family, and what that disease looks like and what it does to not only the alcoholic, but also to the family members and to the extended family members and community at large. So it's really, you know, Zoe, the work that we do, and we've done so much of it, is using art as healing.
So
I just think for me, it was just how fast could I run? As a matter of fact, I went to a therapist because I knew I needed counseling. And I went, but I actually kind of got fired by my therapist. And when I say fired, I don't mean that in a negative way. She didn't really fire me, but she did let me go. Mm. She said, "You're not ready. You're not ready," because I wasn't committed to my own healing. So when you ask, what did that look like? It was canceling appointments.
Oh,
I'm working.
Ooh.
I don't have time. Or I was trying to help my mom or my sister or, you know, whatever else, you know, whatever that looked like. It wasn't Sherry and taking a deep dive into my own process and journey of healing.
How long did it take you to face his passing? Like, how long did it take you to confront that grief? Did you hit a wall? Did you not deal with it?
Wow, that's a good question. I don't know if I have a definitive answer for that. You know, I think grief is one of those things. It's in stages, though, too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's all kinds of stages for grief.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, really. I'm not really sure when I actually felt like maybe I'm still processing some things from his loss, from that loss. But I would say, really, though, with probably like a, he died in 91. And so I think, really, I want to say, really, me diving into my acting career is what really helped me to start the healing process and to begin to be honest about my life, my childhood, more about I was. So I really, I feel like in so many ways, art has, you know, in my prayer life, my faith, certainly for me. But I would definitely say, I think really it's that journey of starting. And then, of course, I started my journey into having my own family. Now I got married and all of that. So, and having kids and,
How soon after your father's passing did you get married?
So he died in 91 and I got married. I got engaged in 94.
Okay.
And then we got married in 96.
So a good minute.
Yeah, no, it was a good minute. And my mom, I mean, she also went through during that time too. So my mom went through her, as we called it, her breakthrough. So the focus really shifted to her because she really, you know, basically, as people call it, you know, a nervous breakdown. And I didn't know what that looked like until it, you know, you always heard that, right? Even the whispers of such and such had a nervous breakdown. until I witnessed it with my mom, from the loss of not only her mom, talk about grief and loss. I mean, not only her husband, but in a very short span of time, it was her husband, then her mother, her father, her brother, her sister, her uncle, her grandmother. And she was their caregiver until their demise.
One right after the other.
Pretty much. Yeah, pretty much. And then my grandmom was the last to transition. And she took such good care of her mom. So she really, her brain really just couldn't handle anymore. She couldn't do anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, she had to be medicated. And that's just a whole nother coming back from the brink of mental illness.
Yeah.
And really being, you know, my sister and I, April, being there for my mom and making sure that you're her advocate. And because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, doctors and institutions,
yeah,
and, you know, they don't always have your loved ones.
That's right.
Full well-being.
That's right.
In mind.
That's right. Yeah.
We'll have a deeper conversation about that another time. But
yeah.
Yeah. So I think too, when you're asking that, which I hadn't thought about really in that way, in terms of how long it took me, I think because of the focus went to my mom too.
So it's almost like, yeah, did you have a chance to grieve? Because then now it's like whiplash, mom, whiplash, engagement. Now all the focus has to go into planning a grand wedding. Boom, then chill. So it's just like all of these things. It's kind of
in the story. And we had our first baby. We got married in September and we were pregnant by December. Because Gaia was born in October.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. I didn't really, maybe that's why. I'm going to have to really journal about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of like talking about Baba Yaga in the story, walking around with all the things in her cauldron, but it's like there were things of her choosing. And sort of now listening to your story on the outside, it's kind of like you had a whole bunch of things thrown into your cauldron, but were they of your choosing? So what I'm going to ask you is, who did you have to become to make it through all of those successions of responsibilities?
Wow. I just got goosebumps over that question. I guess Superwoman. And I've worked really hard to strip that S off my chest though now, because I know that that was not to my benefit.
What did that look like? I'm not your super. Like, what did it look like living that?
To not be the superwoman or what?
No, to be the superwoman. So that people listening, you know, they might not know that they're in like superwoman mode. So let people know what it looks like so they can know, oh, maybe I need to take the cape off.
Yeah, maybe you need to take the cape off. Well, it looks like you trying to be everything to everyone and do everything for everyone and be all, and to do it perfectly. Don't let me leave that out. And that's impossible. I mean, it's impossible to have that role because I'm human. And my mother used to say to me all the time, Sherry, your shoulders are not but so big. You're human.
And to think you can be this superhuman, that you can take on everything and be everything. And it's not true. That's just a facade.
You feel like that was like, because we, you know, society, we get those messages from society. Do you feel like those were societal messages that you got that made you feel like that? Or do you feel like you internally felt like you had to do everything?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, you know, we're old enough to remember, you know, I'm a woman. I fry
fried
and bring it all in. You know, all that.
Never let you forget you're a man.
That's it. Yeah. And proud of it, too. Proud of that. You know, I think that that was an image that I thought I was supposed to carry. Mm-hmm. I think I thought I was supposed to carry that banner. And I think that was an image I was trying to protect.
You think you were fearful?
Maybe I was fearful of just being me. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it comes back to, and I think about that even now, you know, I'm doing this, getting this new certification for coaching certification, and it's a clear beliefs certification coaching. And I'm really starting to take a deep dive into all of my own beliefs, right? To be able to help other people clear their beliefs. And so maybe, you know what I mean? I'm sure there's still sometimes for me, and you know this, Zoe, you've known me long enough to know, I have those remnants of that perfectionism, Jane.
Mm.
But I'm aware of it now. You know, I'm more self-aware. I think what helped me to begin to unravel in a healthy way, start to pull that thread and let that yarn ball start to unravel, is that I had my own panic attack.
Mm. The panic attack.
The panic attack.
Let's talk about the panic attack. Not us laughing at your panic attack.
Not me laughing at my panic attack.
Oh my gosh. Girl, you are just leaving no stone unturned.
You brought up the panic attack. I forgot about the panic attack.
I did. Well, you know what? Because when you were saying to help people hear this.
Yeah.
And to be honest about it.
Yeah.
Because that's what my mom used to say. You know, Sherry, you could end up where I am. Is I basically what she was really trying to say to me. You know what I mean? I think. Because it was too much for one person.
It was too much for her.
It was too much. Mm-hmm. And though she had support, I mean, we were all, you know, she had other friends, certainly circle of sisters, and, you know, me and her, she had her children, you know, in April. But it was still too much.
Right. That's the thing, right? It's like, yeah, we have support. We have people that love us, but there's something that we're just too fucking hard to do.
Alone.
Exactly.
Too hard to do alone.
Too hard to do.
It's just too hard to do.
And, you know, I see people just, I mean, not so much there, but, you know, just putting things on Black women's shoulders, boulder after boulder after boulder after boulder. And I feel like there's a cost to saying no. I feel like there is a cost for any woman identify person to say no, it's too much, it's too heavy, I can't handle it. It's like there's a cost. There's a social cost.
There is. There's a social cost, a physical cost, an emotional cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the price is high.
Yeah. And I feel like we know that on some level. And you're either like willing to pay that cost or you're not.
So you just do it till you can't do it anymore. And sometimes you die.
It's true. It's true. And we are socialized that way, right? To be that strong Black woman.
Sure.
Right? Part of that, right? That's our trope. That's what we carry. That's, I mean, like you said, we're becoming more aware of it now, but it's still there. It's still prevalent.
Yeah.
And so I think for me, when I had that panic attack, first of all, I didn't even realize I was having a panic attack when it came.
Yeah.
My son had been in ICU for a week. It was Hurricane Sandy. We were moved that weekend. We had gone to Connecticut, got a moving truck. We were moving things out because we knew my mom was not going to return to her apartment. So we took her condo. So we were renting out. We were going to rent out. That was her plan, to rent out her condo. Because she wasn't going to be able to return there. She had, as you said, a massive stroke and three within 9 months. At any rate, he was severely asthmatic at that time. He just had this terrible, terrible attack. He ended up going into the hospital. At the time, you know, it was just a lot of pressure. I was also, remember, we were working the contract.
I remember. Yeah.
And you were working with me.
Yes. Yeah, I know.
Right. So every week we spent our time in Atlantic City, right?
Time of our lives.
Having the time of our lives. Working hard though, too. We worked hard. But we did have the time of our lives.
We had the time of our lives. You don't have to tell people we worked hard, okay? We were having
you don't have to lay.
Right, girl. Yeah, look, see, I just want that superwoman.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, keep that approval.
We have the time of our lives and let people use their imagination.
Yeah, use your imagination. We did have the time of our lives.
So fun.
It was a great contract. It was a lot of fun.
Yes.
And then going to Connecticut on the weekends to help clean out my mom's house. So sometimes I would stay there till 2 a.m. Get back on the road to New Jersey, drive back home.
Yeah.
My kids were small then, and they were gymnasts. And
very high achieving children.
High achieving.
Extremely high functioning.
Extremely high functioning. Yeah.
Packed schedules.
Very packed.
Scholars.
Yes. Scholars. Athletes. Like
top athletes.
Yes. Top athletes. Yes. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot. And I also, my father-in-law was living with me at that time.
Oh my God, I forgot about that.
And he had just gotten a place too, because he wanted to be on his own too. So it was near us.
But then it was the moving.
So it was also helping to pack him and move him and get him out. Then all that was happening on that weekend.
Yeah.
So this was the first time I came after Jade came home. After a week in ICU, struggling for breath. And thank goodness he came home. But I'm now, this is the first weekend I was like, I'm not going to go to Connecticut. But I had been, you know, I'm not going to go to Connecticut. So I'm lying in the bed. And I thought, I'll just turn on the television. Then I'll just watch TV. All of a sudden, Zoe, I felt like I was falling into a deep, I can't even explain it. Suddenly I couldn't breathe. Like I couldn't catch my breath. And you know how I was like, okay, I'm going to just take another deep breath. There's something. I was trying to take a deeper breath. I still couldn't catch my breath. And what's going on with me? What's happening? So I run downstairs to tell Dwayne, you know, I can't. There's something wrong with me. Something is happening. And what do I find? He's smoking in the back of our home, thinking the smoke is just going to disappear.
Not worth it.
Okay.
I've gone into fits of fancy over smoking in the house. You already know how many pits.
Listen, I used to smoke in the house too as a smoker. I mean, we were smoking before my kids, well before my kids, but we didn't smoke in our house normally. And it was just such a weird, like, I'm like, I don't know what made him think, like, oh, the smoke is funny. He was in the back. You know what I mean? Thinking like, what? Now, meanwhile, I'm like
on the brink.
Okay. And I'm feeling like I don't even know what to, I can't even breathe. But it just got worse.
Yeah.
Not just because of that. It was just because of everything.
Yeah.
I literally found myself screaming out the door.
Yeah.
And saying, I'm dying.
Yeah.
I mean, I literally had the door open.
Yeah.
And I thought about
Sherry.
I did. You know how dramatic I am. But I'm really not that dramatic type to like run to the hospital. No, you know, I'm not a person going to the hospital.
Okay, that's true. That's me.
I like to keep up my physicals and all that, but I'm not somebody that's just running.
No. Yeah. But you really thought I'm dying. I mean, panic attacks are actually, we're laughing, but they're quite serious. Like this, it's really.
No, this one was serious.
They're
so scary. And it was scary. And it was finally my spirit said, you're having a panic attack. And that's when I finally started doing more research. And I had already done research because of my mom.
Sure.
And I had a wellness practices and journaling and all that kind of thing. Because as an actor, you know, we kind of have that mind-body-spirit connection and wellness practices and rituals that we do. But I clearly...
Yeah, that stuff goes out the window.
No, I needed much more support than that. So that's when I really started taking my own deep dive really, really into my wellness journey and practices because it was, I mean, that long story, but, and, you know, I sent Dwayne out that day and, you know, he did go right out to, and I sent a list of herbs and all of it to get me immediately.
Yeah.
Because I was, you know, I will take the holistic approach before I will take, a more Western medicine approach.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I had a couple up during the pandemic. Terrifying.
I was. And I felt for my mom too in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because I witnessed many of her panic attacks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I felt for her and what she went through.
Yeah.
I know we did a little laughing, but I have a sense of humor just about every tragedy in my life. I can, you know, it's a little levity we need.
Yes. Yeah, you know, we will do that. I will laugh at a tragedy.
You know, laughter.
Even my own.
Yeah. Even my own. I'm laughing now. I mean, laughter is healing for the soul. It is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's medicine for me.
Exactly.
Exactly.
So you started on your journey, you know, digging deeper. And again, let's just also say, this is all very recent. Like we both experienced a succession of like crazy things in a very, like in a decade.
Yeah.
I've only been back on the East Coast for 14 years.
Wow. Thank God.
So it's been like a succession of, you know, little terrors, as I call them. So so you're dealing with your mom, you're acting. By now we're like working on ashes.
Yes.
You're caretaking for your father-in-law, going over to his apartment. Like,
and taking him to appointments and doctors.
And
my mom, you know, we're caretaking for my mom.
And your three high-functioning kids.
High-functioning kids, yes.
Yeah. And so then while all of that's happening, other things are happening in your household as well.
Right.
And so do you want to talk just a little bit about that?
Sure.
I mean, you don't have to. I mean, I did put it in the show notes, though, so you kind of do have to.
Yeah,
you've already put only what notes. In all seriousness, only what you want to say.
I guess what I will say, and I, you know, I'm just not really let spirit lead me on this and guide me through this.
Yeah.
Because whatever I do say, it's meant for healing.
Yes.
For not only for me, but for someone else.
Sure.
Who might be going through something similar.
I mean, that's why we do the work we do, right?
Well, that's the thing, right? Here we are working on this play of about like unraveling truths. And again, you know, I'm dealing with my own tragic relationship stuff.
Yeah.
And my mom and all these things. And you're juggling a million things as well. So it was a rough time.
Yeah. And in the meantime, my marriage was unraveling.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what I will say, you know, you can't outrun grief and you can't outrun trauma. And when those things are present in your life and also in your partner's life,
yeah,
it's just a lot of healing work that needs to be done.
That's right.
And when you don't have that you don't have the opportunity, or you don't take that, because it's a choice.
That's right.
So that means to say not having the opportunity,
yeah.
But when you don't take the opportunity, when you don't choose to get on the path of your healing, to choose to understand your own trauma, your own stories, then you're going to carry that right into your family.
Yeah.
And the story,
yeah.
I am going to tell more of the story through art,
through
my show, which
That's
you
right.
know, Cherry Red Sweet Escape.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So, and I decided, you know, to own more of my own truth and not to keep running from that.
Yeah.
And again, it's not about bashing anyone.
Yeah.
But it is about healing and it is about truth telling.
Yeah, I feel that because I was just talking with a new friend about this last week. Like, I'm very much, I will just say whatever is going on. I got lipstick on my thing. Lipstick on you?
Who put that there?
Girl, I just wish Fenty would fix their formula, Rihanna. I sure wish you could get somebody to fix that formula because this lipstick bleeds everywhere.
While anyway, you were doing that, I thought I'd do a freshen up.
So. Yeah. So, yeah. So I very much just say what I have to say and think about the consequences after. I'll write a whole book about it. I'll write a play about it. I'll write a movie about it. And then get terrified afterwards and think about the repercussions of my truth on other people.
Yeah.
Because even though it is our story, it's not bashing, but there is still a part, I think, even with the things that I've shared on the podcast, it's like there is a part of me that still wants to protect my family. But on some level, there's just this other part of me where it's like, I just have to like share my side.
Yeah, I feel that way too. I mean, I think for me getting to this point of starting to even share my journey, of, you know, especially, you know, the divorce, we went from fairy tale, I say this, right? From fairy tale to Shakespearean tragedy, right? So maybe that'll be my book. I don't know. But what I will say is that it's just really important, I think, for all of us to know that, you know, listen, you have to do the work on yourself first. Because you sure can't change anyone else.
Yeah.
And you can't control anyone else.
Yeah.
You can't control their behavior or what they do. And so for me, I really tried to, you know, and it was a tough divorce.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of loss. And like you said, 26 years is a long time. It was painful. And there's still, like you said, it's still fresh. It's still recent.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just been 2 years. So it's not easy. And it's still a tremendous loss. And it's grief. I mean, I think I've been going through the stages of grief, but also stepping into new possibility as well. You know.
How are you grieving now versus how you grieved in your 20s?
I definitely have more compassion for myself.
Mm.
Much more grace.
Mm.
For myself. Much more self-reflection. Being more truthful and honest with myself. Standing inside of myself. You know, holding myself, sometimes even physically holding myself. I mean, one of these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you will do that. You will definitely hug yourself.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. Well, I'm doing it now. Feels good. Yeah, no, really just hold myself and hold. And I also, the other thing that's really different is I don't stay in the story like I used to. I used to get stuck in the story.
We did used to get stuck. Oh my God. We would just go on.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yours.
And give that story. And then you're reliving that same story, the energy that you give to it, what you're doing to your body, what you're doing to your brain chemistry. Yeah. I mean, all of it.
Oh my God.
No.
And then we were just like, I'm tired of talking about this. Like, we're not going to keep sick of this.
Yeah.
Just talking about it.
No, you can't just keep talking about it. And I think that's definitely something I've moved beyond that. And, you know, my mom used to always say to me too, you know, Sherry, it's not about being right. It's about having peace of mind.
Yeah.
So my peace, honey, don't come up in here.
Don't, you and your don't bring me no bad news. Don't bring me no bad news.
You can bring me some bad news if you want, but don't come up here acting up.
Don't come rap, tap, tap, tap it on.
Don't come rap, as you say, don't come rap, tap, 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 tap on my door with crazy.
Don't come rap.
No, the only drama now that I want. I mean, I think that was a time when I was younger.
Yeah.
There is, like, you know, you're a little addicted to drama in terms of, I think, being a child of an alcoholic.
Well, I was going to say, it's just familiar. It's like,
it was familiar. And what I mean,
drama and intrigue and.
Right.
And how the Apostle Hollywood.
Correct. And I think I took a lot of it in terms of adventure.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
We always had a story to tell.
I always had a story to tell.
A crazy story.
Some crazy story. Something happening. Yeah. Yeah. And because you know what? Because you go along and you're waiting for the landmine.
Yeah.
You're waiting for the explosion.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like the pain body, right? We get addicted to the pain body. We get addicted to.
Yeah, for sure.
Trauma. We get addicted to the trauma.
Absolutely.
Right. And so for me, that is definitely something I have worked on and changing that pattern of behavior. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I will say I'm proud of that.
I was going to say, great job.
Thank you.
Great job.
You too, girl.
Thanks. Yeah, we're out of here. We're doing good stuff. So besides like your hugging yourself, your candles, your journaling, what other emotional like modalities are you working on right now?
Well, prayer is first and foremost. Yes. I mean, definitely my prayer. My faith and my prayer. But yoga practice, meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Walking, exercise, releasing, you know, some great release rituals, self-care practices.
Mm-hmm.
And not for me, just self-care of going to get your nails done and all that.
Right. Really, for me, self-care is really about, and that's a nice thing to do for yourself, too. I do enjoy that, or when you get a day in the salon with the girl and all that, or we go out to a great dinner.
Massages,
all that is good. But you know what? I'm learning to also get myself my own massages, right? As part of my own self-care, you know, mirror work.
Oh, yes.
I do a great deal of mirror work.
Yeah.
You know, the journaling and self-reflection, affirmations. You know, I have affirmations all over my house.
You sure do. You're also good at talking yourself off the ledge. Now, Sherry, you know, such and such and such and such.
You're good at that, too.
I do a lot of talking to myself.
You do. You do. Yeah.
I talk myself off the ledge. I talk myself from the brink.
Yes.
But I also, you know what? There is something really transformative about the brain.
Yes.
Because
it's that's what I've been saying.
It's the portal.
Brain is the portal.
The brain is the portal.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not really until I'm on the brain that's where the transformation really does happen. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so anyway, I mean, I think for me, you know, I have the series with my clients, it's stepping out of the stretch zone.
Yeah.
You know, I do a lot of trainings and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Stepping out of the stretch zone, I started that series because I said, you know, Sherry, you actually lived your life mostly in the stretch zone. Playing outside of my comfort zone in so many respects.
Yes.
Because my natural inclination is to, you know, I really don't like taking a bite of the apple at one bite at a time. I'd rather swallow it whole. And that's not always to my benefit either.
Yeah.
You know, process. And I'm an actor and I do enjoy process. Right. Yeah. But there's also something about, for me, going on the diving board and just jumping.
Yeah.
Into the deep end and say, uh-oh.
But wait.
Let me know this.
Oh, my God. I'm in water well over my head.
Of course.
Okay, I got to learn how to swim. I'm going to swim. That's it. Because sometimes that's the only way that I'll take action. And I'll
Yeah.
I love it. I love being that way.
I do, too. Yeah. I do, too. You're my soul sister in that way, too.
Of course.
Well, you know, we have so much synergy.
I know, but we want it to be any other way. So now you're doing this work with other people. So, you know, you're taking people in the stretch zone and then you have Dramasize. How did that come about?
Oh, that started off Dramasize. So Dramasize is a, you know what it is, but I'll just, for your listeners, and hopefully they're still with us.
They are. Even if they're listening in the car, I mean, it's fine.
Yes. So Dramasize is really about pulling from the actor's toolkit, because acting is the study of human behavior. I've learned so much about myself, which helps me to learn about other people, which helps me to learn about the world. Then infusing wellness practices and tools and principles in it and other creative modalities. And so that's Dramasize. And my background is arts education. I believe in the arts. I think wellness is art. Art is wellness. Doing these trainings, and I've seen how people, and you've seen it too, Zoe, with the work we've done with Ashes and other work that we've done, it really helps to transform people's lives and in a space where it's without judgment.
Yeah.
Right. In a space that you can create, where you can give yourself permission to really just look at what is.
Yeah.
And encourage people just to be better observers of their own life and of themselves, and to start understanding why you make the choices you made, you know, starting to tap into excavating more truth, like peeling back an onion, right? Peeling back all the layers like we do as we study a character. So I really just try to offer people to be their own main character in their own life, because they really are. This is your life and your stage. It's your life.
What else are you working on?
Well, you know, Well, you know, there's Dreamers Unite with Sherry Pullum. Thank you for mentioning that. There's my little shameless plug. Mm-hmm. The talk show for Dreamers, which you've been on and you're going to come back. I know we're starting a new season.
Yeah.
That's really all about people just sharing their stories, right? And the good, the bad, the indifferent. How do we manifest those dreams? You know, what's the journey to get there? And then also keeping it fun. We play dream games, and there's a question and answer where people could actually call in and ask. I'm doing a podcast in the studio, which is really mostly about talking all things entertainment. So all aspects, to me, everything is entertainment. Right? Because it's all about storytelling. Everything. No matter, you know, hospitals have an aspect of entertainment. Churches, I mean, there's this aspect of storytelling in it. So letting people know, too, how entertainment really, it can have a seedy side, but it also has a very powerful side that can be very, very, use it for social justice work that you and I have done and used it in that way. I think that's important. Advocacy work for my company, doing documentaries for Black and Brown people, stories for women and Black and Brown people of color, stories, marginalized people, stories that won't get told because our stories are important and valuable. All stories are, but some stories will not see the light of day unless we tell them.
Yeah.
And if we don't tell our own stories, sometimes they won't get told in a meaningful way.
Absolutely.
Or in the way that is important.
Absolutely.
For us.
Yep.
Yeah. So, yeah. And I'm still acting. And of course, I mentioned Cherry Red Sweet Escape. So I am excited. We do plan on filming it this year.
Okay.
And I'm really grateful for the beautiful team that I have. And Zoe, you worked on Cherry Red Sweet Escape with me, which is really about a mom who is escaping into her diva alter ego. And now we learn more about why she's escaping.
Really?
She's a mom and a wife escaping, and she's escaping from her trauma. And so people will get a chance to see how she creates this alter ego and see how she learns from that. So there's also a bit of fantasy in it too, as well as some social justice talk. And I'm just human, humanity, and relatable stories. And empowering stories, and to empower women. So, yeah.
Yep. And how can people support your work, support you?
Well, they can follow me on IG. They can...
What's your Instagram?
At Pullum Productions and at Dreamers Unite Show. They can also please follow Dreamers Unite with Sherry Pullum. You can go on YouTube and subscribe. Comment. So when you watch a video or you watch something, we know how important it is.
Yeah.
To just make some comments, to put a thumbs up, to hit that. My website is pullumproductions.com. So, yeah. So if there's something you want to approach me with, whether it's doing some speaking in your community or some healing work through Dramasize, or, you know, coming on as a guest to Dreamers Unite, or, you know, I also produce other television shows, series. I'm stepping into that space. You and I are doing that together too, Zoe.
Look at her face.
Hello.
Okay. Yeah, she is. She's looking around. Yeah. No, but I have some other projects.
Yeah.
We have some other things we're going to be doing together.
Okay. So we'll make sure that all those get in the show notes.
Yeah, no, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
Really, just send me some love.
Yeah.
Is what I say. Just energetically think of me sometimes and just, you know, send some energetic love my way.
Yeah.
I could always use that.
I love that. So as we come to a close, you know, I always ask, what are you grieving and what are you grateful for today?
And in the terms of the what am I grieving, is that in terms of sort of releasing and letting go? Or it can
if
be
there's
like,
something you're grieving, you can share it. If there's nothing you're grieving, then there's no. I actually had somebody on. I knew he wasn't going to have anything that he was grieving. And he was like, yeah, I really don't have anything I'm grieving right now. And I was like, that's fantastic.
You know what? I won't say that because I will definitely be honest and say, you know, I am still grieving through the process of going through this process of loss of my marriage. I'm still grieving that. I'm still not 100%, if I'm completely honest.
Yeah.
I'm still, you know, healing, and my kids are still healing. You know, I pray my ex is healing because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we're all family. And it matters. Even though we're not the same structurally type of family unit, but it matters to be a healed unit.
Yeah, for sure.
It matters. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I would say that. And I would say, what am I grateful for? Girl, how much time do you have?
I used to sing that song to me.
Grateful. I'll spare people my singing.
But well, yes. I just did it and I can't even
sing.
You can actually hear it too.
Yeah. I tried it sometimes. I'm grateful for breath. I'm grateful for life. I'm grateful for my family, my children. I'm grateful for my sisterhood. Zoe, you know how grateful I am for you. And just I'm grateful for transformation. I'm grateful for all the hard lessons that I've had to learn. I'm grateful, you know, for my family, my parents who taught me so much. I'm grateful for ancestors. I'm grateful that I'm on the brink. And I'm grateful that I could literally just be present with you in this moment and show up as myself.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. This is fancy camp stick.
So
good.
Thank you, Zoe.
Yeah, that's fabulous.
Because you're fabulous.
Yes, I agree.
You are.
Thank you.
You make any guest feel right at home.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank
you. Yes.
Y'all are easy to love.
Well, and you are too. You are too.
And I know people are going to get so many gems from this conversation. So yeah, in all seriousness, just thank you for coming forward, for telling your story. We look forward to you sharing even more through your artistic projects that are coming down the pike. And yeah, I know people are going to just be deeply inspired. So next week on Come to the Brink, we continue exploring courageous journeys through grief and loss and healing. We are going to be talking with Becky Crowell. And Becky and I are going to be pondering grief as a portal and unconditional love, art and exploration and all of those things. So thank you all again for listening. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe, like do all the things. As you know, episodes drop every Tuesday at 7:11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, with some bonus episodes dropping on Fridays. And of course, you find us, you know, wherever you find your podcasts, you'll find us. So if anything moved you today from this conversation, please reach out. You know, let's talk about it, because remember, none of us should be standing on the bridge alone. I am Zoe Flowers, and I will see y'all soon. Bye.